Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this Courthouse Dubs or Argument program on Cox Communications versus Sony Music Entertainment, which was argued before the court yesterday. We're very pleased to welcome our moderator, Professor Zvi Rosen, who is a professor at the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law and a former scholar in residence at the U.S. Copyright Office. Professor Rosen also signed and assisted in writing an amicus brief in support of Sony. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we'll turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I will note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Professor Rosen, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you, Sarah. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a discussion of what is no doubt the year's most hotly contested case at the U.S. Supreme Court, Sony versus Cox. I'm being a bit in jest, because it's actually an enormously important case for copyright law and really the digital economy more generally. As mentioned, I'm Zvi Rosen. I teach at University of New Hampshire's Franklin Pierce School of Law. And I'll be introducing the case a little bit and then handing things off to Devlin Hartline, who is a senior fellow at Hudson Institute's Forum for Intellectual Property. So this case has been going on for over 10 years now. In 2014, a group of record companies, including BMG, sued Cox Communications. They had been sending takedown notices to Cox, which is a major internet service provider, mostly in the Southeast United States, requesting that they terminate repeat infringers and otherwise take action against repeat infringers. Cox developed the 13-strike plan for dealing with repeat infringers, which is important because although copyright law doesn't require one to avoid liability generally, it's required for the 512 liability shield. Now, and that's why we haven't had more of these cases, really. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 1998 provides at section 512A that an internet service provider that serves as a passive conduit is effectively shielded from liability if, among other things, they take action to terminate repeat infringers. Now, usually speaking, frankly, there's been a partnership between the ISP and the big content companies whereby a plan is worked out and they do that. Cox got tired of this, and in one particularly damning email that actually got mentioned at oral argument at the Supreme Court, someone who worked for Cox said, and I quote verbatim, F the DMCA. You might be surprised to learn that after that, the court found that Cox did not have protection of Section 512A because they had not reasonably implemented a repeat infringer plan, as even though they had it, they consciously chose to ignore it. That all happened in advance of this case. So Cox has lost for shield. The question now is, are they liable under theories of secondary liability for the infringement of their users? The two theories that are possible are vicarious liability, which is that there was a right and ability to control the user and they profited from it, and contributory liability, which means, I'll let Devlin go into much more on this, but you knew about it and made a material contribution. Now, Cox couldn't really argue they didn't know about it. So the question is, what does material contribution mean? And the first question presented is, does acting as an ISP mean you've made a material contribution to the infringement? The second question, and one that was curiously absent at trial, was what does willfulness mean? And what is a material standard for willfulness for damages? And that goes to the question of how much statutory damages can be. So we'll get to that in a bit. But Devlin, can you tell us a little more about contributory infringement and what and what you think about it?
Yeah. Well, hi, Zvi. It's always great to chat copyright law with you. And thanks to the FedSoc for hosting this. So the argument was just yesterday. I listened to it while I read along. And I have so many thoughts. I probably need to listen to it and read it maybe a couple more times. But yeah, they're all over the place. It's somehow, what happened to willfulness? There's two questions presented. What happened to willfulness? So I think the best way to talk about what happened yesterday is to talk about something that happened like a decade ago. And it's not even this case, it's a different case. So if you'll allow me, I'd like to go way back to the year 2018. And so it's the same exact defendant, Cox Communications. So they provide internet service, right? You sign up, get high-speed internet. But it was different plaintiffs. So there, it was BMG. And I think this was mostly, instead of record labels, it was mostly publishers, I believe, in that case. And so BMG owns the copyright in musical compositions. Cox is the high-speed internet provider. And so BMG sued Cox and said, hey, your subscribers are infringing. We've been telling you they're infringing, and you're not cutting them off, right? And so there, the district court in Virginia, I believe, said that Cox had lost its safe harbor. So Zvi talked about that. So it's super important. And it's a little bit different because Cox is a conduit, right? So there's 512A, which is conduits. A lot of the cases that you hear about are 512C cases. So this is services like Facebook or YouTube, where there's uploaded content from users, right? And so they have the ability to remove the content from their servers. But this is just providing the dumb pipes where, you know, information gets exchanged. So the district court said they lost their safe harbor and they're liable for willful contributory infringement. So willful matters for damages, and we'll get to that in a little bit, but contributory infringement. So there was a jury instruction, and it said that Cox either knew or should have known about the infringement. And so the knowledge came from these notices that I think it was Rights Corp in that case was, so they were hired by the labels and or by the publishers. And so they were sending, you know, thousands of these things saying it's whoever subscribes at this address, they're infringing over and over. But notice that the standard here is knowledge. So it's new, which is actual knowledge, which you subjectively know, or should have known, which is constructive knowledge. It's what a reasonable person would have known in those circumstances. So some kind of knowledge, and that Cox materially contributed to it. So somehow they assisted in it in a way. So the court also said you can have willful blindness, which is, it's equivalent to actual knowledge. Basically, you have aware of a high probability that users are infringing and you consciously avoid confirming it. So it's like putting your head in the sand or something, right? And so Cox had all kinds of arguments. It said, well, sure, we have to have a repeat infringer policy, but what is an infringer? Z, does it mean somebody who's been adjudicated an infringer, right? And so how would that work? Like they don't have to get rid of somebody until like they've literally been sued and lost twice in federal court? Like that doesn't make any sense. So, you know, and this is what I love about this. And I believe this is Judge O'Grady. Am I right? Liam O'Grady? Okay. So he's awesome. Love him. But here's what he says. So you just have to have a reasonable repeat infringer policy. And what is reasonable? I don't know. There's a lot of leeway. But what he says is, you know, I'm not even going to say whether your policy was reasonable. You didn't follow it, right? So it was 13 strikes. And then we disconnect you, but then the next day we reconnect you, right? And there's always emails. They always have the emails. So Zvi mentioned the F the DMCA one, which is, you know, pretty terrible coming from from the guy at Cox. Excuse me. But, you know, there are emails where They were saying DMCA equals reactivate, right? So it says terminate. We terminated them. It doesn't say terminate for how long, right? So, and there was another one where they said, well, let's not cut that guy off. He's paying us $400 a month. Like, you know, the emails are not great. And so Cox tried to say, look, we don't have knowledge. And so they argued this argument that we've seen a lot in the last 40 years, which is that Cox can't be contributorily liable since its technology is capable of substantial non-infringing use. And so copyright lawyers will recognize this from the Sony v. Universal decision, which was in 1984. So this will be the third time the Supreme Court's looked at contributory copyright infringement in like the last 50 years. So the first time was in 1984 with VCRs. So the question is, is Sony liable if it sells a Betamax machine with the general knowledge that somebody might infringe with it, right? And then we had Grokster 20 years later, 2005. So that is a peer-to-peer case. Like, this is a peer-to-peer case. Except for there, Grokster wasn't an ISP in the way that Cox was. And there it was a different flavor of contributory infringement called inducement. And we'll get to that in a little bit. So Judge O'Grady said, or not O'Grady, the Fourth Circuit said that this is meritless, right? Capable of substantial non-infringing use. And so the court said, the Fourth Circuit, that you can sell a product that has lawful and unlawful uses. Merely selling that product does not establish an intent to infringe. So there's no imputed intent. And so this is what the court said in Grokster when it was trying to clean up the mess it had made in Sony. It's not about imputed intent. You can't presume or impute intent to cause infringement solely from the design or distribution of a product that has substantial non-infringing uses. But that doesn't mean that you can't ever be contributorily liable. So providing a product that has substantial non-infringing uses can constitute material contribution. So we've seen cases like Google's search engine for images. It substantially assists people in finding infringing images. So, you know, if they don't remove these images once they have knowledge, then they can be liable as on a material contribution theory. And so what matters is whether the product is distributed with the intent to cause infringement. So let's get to the jury instructions. So in this, and remember, we're talking about BMG. So the Fourth Circuit says, look, the jury instructions were wrong. The test is not new or should have known. It's not knowledge. It's not actual knowledge. It's not negligence, constructive knowledge, whatever you want to call it. You have to have some kind of intent. And so how did they get this? Well, they got this from the Grokster case 2005, where the Supreme Court basically inadvertently introduced some confusion into the doctrine. And so there they were talking about inducement. So inducement is an intent standard. You have to take affirmative steps and actively encourage infringement. And they said contributory liability requires some kind of intent, but they were talking about the inducement flavor, not the material contribution flavor, which is why we're here now, where both sides and the government is arguing, hey, you have to have some kind of intent. And so if you, how does Sony Music or BMG, like, how do they get intent? Well, they say if you sell a product with knowledge that a buyer will infringe, then you know it's going to happen. So that knowledge, and then we're going to call it a presumption of intent. And so there's a common law doctrine that says if you know that consequences are certain or substantially certain to follow from a given act or, I guess, omission, and you still do the thing or don't do the thing, then it's treated as if you wanted that thing to happen. So the Fourth Circuit said you have to have intent, but that's okay. We're going to infer intent based on knowledge. And so I want to turn it over to to Zvi, because I've been talking for a long time, but I do want to get back on this, you know, where I think things went wrong.
It's so interesting because we've had this, these sort of soup of cases from the Supreme Court. And one of my pet peeves is people taking the money quote from a Supreme Court case and not reading the whole opinion. And I think Sony versus Universal introduced a staple of commerce. And what we've seen is a litany of cases following it where people tried to apply staple of commerce and take it farther and ignore how really fact-bound I think Sony is in the staple of commerce doctrine, which is why staple of commerce, substantial non-infringing use has, I can't think of too many cases offhand where it's really been, where it's been a successful argument outside of pretty analogous situations involving consumer electronics. Then Grokster, in the Grokster case, I mean, some of our younger viewers might remember what Grokster was. It was basically the successor to Napster, and the court was frankly trying, I mean, it was a little bit of a struggle because clearly this was a pirate service, but it didn't fit naturally, perhaps under existing prongs. And there was all this argument about applying Sony, and the Supreme Court said, no, we'll import the inducement, which existed heavily in patent law, but had not been found too often in copyright law before that. And inducement, as you say, has an intent requirement. Wires definitely got crossed here a little bit between inducement and material contribution. And these are separate flavors of it. Now, of course, this all goes back to the Gershwin case, which was involves a company, Columbia Artist Management. It's very confusing because you keep thinking it's Columbia Records, but it's a different company. And Columbia Artist Management was booking people in nightclubs knowing they were performing infringing songs. And of course, therefore, we'd had contributory liability way earlier. We had the Ben-Hur case from 1911, where the court held that the distributor of a movie was contributorily liable, the U.S. Supreme Court. But in the Gershwin case, the Second Circuit really defined material contribution. They said contributory liability. They said it's knowledge and material contribution. They also gave us the definition of vicarious liability. And one of the interesting questions in this case is after Cox petitioned for cert to define material contribution and to define willfulness, Sony said, well, if we're doing that, we should go back to the Fourth Circuit ruling, which said no vicarious liability, which is right and ability to control and profit. Court did not decide to take that up as well. So we're getting a little bit of a skewed review, perhaps, where only the pro Sony stuff is being reviewed, not the pro Cox stuff. I'm sorry. I mean, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, no, and it's always like that. I mean, you've got the facts that you've got certain arguments that were forfeited for whatever reason. And, you know, so it's not like you come into the Supreme Court with your full arsenal of that you would want to have. But yeah, I want to talk about staple article of commerce, because I hear this brought up in copyright law circles. And, you know, before Sony, nobody was ever talking about substantial non-infringing uses in the copyright law context. So the doctrine comes from patent law. And I think the first clue when courts, the Supreme Court and parties start talking about these doctrines under patent law is they're codified, right? So why are they codified? 271B is inducement. 271C is contributory. And it's codified because the courts screwed it up so bad, including the Supreme Court. So the doctrine in patent law, staple article of commerce. If you sell something that's a staple article of commerce, that's capable of substantial non-infringing uses, in patent law, you can never, ever, ever be contributorily liable. It doesn't matter if you know, if you intend, if it's your purpose that somebody's going to take that staple article and infringe with it. It doesn't matter. You're not a contributory infringer. Copyright law has never adopted that law, that rule, right? So you could picture a 2x4. It's a piece of lumber. People can use it. for anything. It's got lots of non-infringing uses. But say somebody has a patented combination, which is where this doctrine came up. So a patented combination is a patented machine that's made up of a bunch of unpatented parts. And so a 2x4 may be one of those unpatented parts. And so because it can be used for non-infringing purposes, you can sell the 2x4, right? It's a staple article of commerce. The flip side are non-staple articles. And so these are things that are literally good for nothing else except for infringing. And so the big Supreme Court case there was Arrow 1 and 2. It was in the 1960s. And so this was with the fabric that was for convertibles. You know, if you've ever had a convertible, you know, the fabric goes bad. And so they were cutting this fabric to fit specific cars, like a 1962 Mustang, you know, and it was only cut for that one car. Well, the convertible top, the whole system of it, is a patented combination, and they were selling a part that was good for nothing else except for that one car. And so the court said, well, that's contributory infringement, right? So, but this doesn't make sense. And copyright law, like we're not talking about copyrighted combinations. Nobody's selling individual parts of copyrighted works. You know, like it just like it makes no sense. It doesn't make any sense. And so why did it get codified? So the big problem was with patent misuse. And so a lot of the parties, and including at the argument, they were quoting this Henry versus A.B. Dick Supreme Court case from 1912. And, you know, in the briefs, people say, oh, it was overruled on other grounds. Well, yeah, it was overruled on other grounds, but it's like no longer good law. If it was good law at all, it was like for a couple of years. And then it was, you know, legislatively overruled by Congress in the 1952 Patent Act. But sure, let's keep quoting that case, you know. And so the reason Congress stepped in is because the courts were all over the place. Like they wanted to protect patent owners from people selling parts that would be used to infringe. But then, you know, these are staple articles of commerce, and they don't want the wheels of commerce to grind to a halt. And so the problem was it was an antitrust issue. It was patent misuse. So they're trying to extend the monopoly of their patent rights past the patented machine into the unpatented parts. And so big codification in 1952, and Congress adopted a very narrow definition of contributory patent infringement. And this was on the heels of the Supreme Court, two decisions in the 40s, Mercoid 1 and 2, where they said, basically, there's no such thing as contributory patent infringement. And Congress was like, wait, what? So they were just trying to balance these things. But none of these things exist in copyright law. Why in the heck are we looking at patent law? It makes no sense. And so here's the original sin. And I was very happy. I think it was Paul Clement cited footnote 19 from Sony v. Universal, and I have it highlighted here in orange and purple. That means it's very important in my system. And they said, you know, we're looking to patent law because of the historic kinship between copyrights and patents, and the kinship being that they're both in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8, I guess, instead of Clause 3 for trademark law. And they said, if we were applying the standard from trademark law, this would be a super crazy easy case. Sony does not intentionally induce customers to make infringing copies, and it doesn't supply its product to identified individuals who are known to be engaging in continuing infringement. And so, yeah, Sony could have been a one sentence opinion, and that would be the sentence, and we would be in a very different place right now.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because there were moments at the Supreme Court where I saw some attempts to start to say, well, is contributory infringement a thing at all? Which I don't think even Cox really argued, and I think some people were alarmed. And Paul Clement said, well, actually authorized was particularly added, and legislative history is crystal clear on this, where the House report says authorized means that contributory and vicarious infringement continues. The exact quote in my brief. But That's a funny thing. When you get to the Supreme Court, you're always getting, there's some wild cards involved.
It's like they only spelled it out in patent law because it was just so crazy. Like, it was like 40 years of craziness where they kept changing the rules. The court kept flipping on itself and like nobody knew what the rule was. Right. But like, we haven't had that problem in trademark law. We haven't had that problem in copyright law. We haven't had that problem in like tort law, generally intentional torts. You don't always have a statute that says, here's how you figure out who, you know, the main tortfeasor is and who's jointly liable. Like, you don't need those statutes. These are just background principles of law. And so, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, I love the textual hook is the word authorize. I mean, like, okay. But even if it didn't say authorize, we would still have the liability for indirect copyright infringement, right? Like, you don't need to authorize. Like, I don't think the trademark statute has a textual hook like that.
I've been cold called. I don't know the answer offhand, but
I'm here to get the class. Yeah, me either. I mean, I'm not going to look it up, but yeah. So, yeah, but it's interesting. So that, you know, they pull this out, but I think one of the really important things from Sony is this idea of an ongoing relationship, right? And so you have different connections, right? So Sony makes this VCR, you know, they sell it to, I don't know, Best Buy. You go to Best Buy, you buy it. You don't have any connection with Sony anymore with a VCR. I mean, things are different now. Like, I still have a TiVo. I'm looking at it right now. And my TiVo it checks in with the TiVo service, I think, like every couple of days to make sure I have a paid account, you know? And so there is like some kind of ongoing thing there, but but the reason why that matters is because it's about control. And Sony doesn't have any control over what somebody does with a VCR after they buy it, you know, pretty much none whatsoever. Whereas Cox, you know, Grokster, they all have some kind of more control. So Grokster was this decentralized thing and they didn't really know like who was sharing what. And I'm guessing like with Cox as an ISP, if assuming your traffic is encrypted, they don't know what you're downloading, but they can tell like if you're going to certain pirate sites or you're, you know, most families use 500 gigabytes a month and you used to like 50 trillion bytes. I don't know, you know, like they could tell certain things about you, right? But it's the fact that they can do something about it. And so what is the thing you're supposed to do? You're supposed to cut people off. And so Zvi, like that really, I think, is a big problem here. And it's like, you want to say that we don't want the Coxes of the world, the YouTubes or whatever, like just not doing anything, right? So that was the point of the DMCA, was to get some kind of cooperation, you know. But like, do we really want Cox like disconnecting the internet to a university or a hospital or even like individual subscribers, you know? And maybe if you live somewhere where you have a lot of choices for ISPs, maybe it's not a big deal, but what if Cox is like your only choice, you know? And so that seems like really strong medicine, and I don't have a good answer for it. And I kind of felt like, and I'm curious what you think. Do you think that Sony and Clement, like, they had a good answer? Like, what was his answer? You should just throttle internet to a whole university? Like, really?
Yeah, I mean, the honest answer, and it's interesting, and we have stuff in the Q&A saying that ISPs shouldn't have to police. And of course, ISPs aren't for police. They get takedown requests, which itself is a little tricky because, frankly, it creates a system where the majors who have the money to pay people like Rights Corp and others to do the policing for them do it, whereas the small players end up basically just throwing up their hands and saying, there's not much I can do all too often. But it is a problem for Sony that, I mean, listen, the DMCA was drafted in 98. And while I think some of the arguments that it's outdated are dramatically overstated, and if you look at the history of DMCA, they saw what was coming pretty clearly. It was not a case where they didn't get it. I do think internet disconnection was less of a problem in 1998 than it is today. And I think the answer, in practice, the answer is going to be that, well, first of all, I mean, this case started, what? I mean, I know the case was filed in 2014, but I think the problems obviously predate that. So I assume, frankly, that a lot of this comes from a torrent era, when there was a lot of, where I suppose, frankly, the streaming era, the traffic's not going to look the same. And the concerns of the content holders are not the same. Things like felony streaming and operating pirate streaming sites are much more of a concern. And I think end user conduct is much less of a concern. But I think the honest answer, and I don't think that the IP, that a lot of IP holders want to say this out loud, is that to some degree, the idea of disconnecting someone is kind of, for most cases, a thing of the past. Now, if you are running a pirate streaming site like a Plex server out of your house, heck yes. I mean, and I think there's an argument for, yeah, disconnection is appropriate. If you're actually running a pirate server out of your house, I think the response is still disconnection. I think there's going to be a lot of wariness regarding downloading in 2025 and having that as a reason why, but I do not speak for the industry, to say the least, and they may well disagree.
Yeah, well, I mean, sure, it's the case is old, and I was kind of surprised that people are still doing peer-to-peer. Like, I wanted to get some kind of music, though. It's like a Grateful Dead live show. And I saw on Reddit, somebody said, oh, go to this website. So I went to the website, and it was like, oh, you have to join the swarm. And I was like, I don't remember how to do that. That was a long time ago, right? But you know, it's interesting because we were talking about 512A conduit and 512C, like, you know, people upload material. And so there isn't even a mechanism in 512 for sending like a notice to an ISP like Cox, right? The notices in 512C like kind of presume that this is content that they could take down. But like, as you brought up, people are streaming more now, right? And so it's not like a video on YouTube that YouTube can take down. You've got these streaming platforms. And from what I understand, a lot of them are not located in the USA. And so, I mean, this is not really the issue in this case, but you probably know what I'm about to get at, Zvi, which is like, it seems like the problem isn't that we need to cut off internet subscribers who are going to these like international piracy streaming sites. It's like, why don't we cut off these international piracy sites from U.S. subscribers in the first place? And so there's been a few bills in the last couple of years that, you know, talk about this. And it's I forget what they call it now, but it's like judicial site blocking. It's some kind of, you know, the latest bill is you go to court, it's all, you know, you have to show that they're dedicated to piracy and you can get an order, serve it on an ISP. It seems to me like this is what we should be talking about, is why don't we block these foreign streaming sites rather than like, you know, how much are we going to throttle the internet to a university that has 30,000 students, like, which doesn't seem reasonable to me. Yeah.
Well, so I mean, and of course, there's two answers. And one, which I don't think you mentioned, is that the damages award was extremely high. It was close to $1 billion at one point in this case. I know it's gone up and down over the years.
It was actually exactly $1 billion.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah. And the math did not add up. It was like 10,017 works, and then they're just like a billion.
I mean, you can do that with statutory damages.
Sure, you can do whatever you want. Yeah.
So I think why it's at the Supreme Court is the amount of money involved makes it worth it. But I do think, of course, this is not really a current copyright issue, but the current copyright issues are really about felony streaming and AI. And one thing that I didn't fully appreciate, and we may end up getting a submarine vehicle for reducing or not the damages for AI infringement. Because if we look at what happened in the Anthropic case, they were sued by authors to all the books, essentially, in a class action. The court gave them a mixed holding, but found that they had to show that they hadn't unlawfully downloaded them, they denied summary judgment. And Anthropic found they could not produce a bond, because for the appeal bond, it would have to be the damages per the maximum damages, which is $150,000 for willful infringement times 800,000 or so, which is multi-trillions of dollars.
That's like $1 trillion. Yeah, that's crazy.
So also in this case is a question of whether Cox's activity is willful. Now, Cox would definitely love to get her damages reduced to $30,000 max. Although I recall from the damages amount in this case, it wouldn't be that much actually affected if it's the $30,000 cap. But the AI industry very much cares about getting the maximum damages reduced and getting a definition of willful infringement that will mean that downloading material for AI training, using it for AI training is not willful, because that caps the damages at $30,000 per work and dramatically changes the settlement discussion and how much a bond will be on appeal. So I do think that's one area where, I mean, I'm not sure if you have any thoughts on that, but one area where this case might have collateral impacts that, like we said, no one mentioned willfulness, but it's in the question presented. It's in the briefs.
Yeah. Well, and we didn't really talk about the question presented, which probably would have made sense at the start. But yeah, just to be clear, that $1 billion jury verdict was taken away by the Fourth Circuit. And so the problem was, it wasn't clear whether that was tied to the vicarious finding or the contributory finding. And the court said there is no vicarious liability here. So Cox charges subscribers a set amount every month. It doesn't matter if they're huge infringers or not. And so, and a few courts have said, you know, it's not a draw to the Cox internet service that, you know, the piracy that's going on. And so just because of the way the jury form was done, it got thrown out. So, but the question of willfulness is there. And so I'll answer the question you asked like 30 minutes ago, what's the question presented? So the first one is whether the Fourth Circuit got it wrong in holding Cox liable for materially contributing to the infringement merely because it failed to terminate accounts. And so what Cox is saying here is that its inaction is not enough. And so there has to be some kind of culpable conduct with the purpose of furthering infringement. And so this is what I believe to be the standard for inducement, but not the standard for contributory infringement material contribution theory, right? And then the second question is, can Cox be a willful infringer without proof that it knew or recklessly disregarded that its own conduct was illegal? And so the mere knowledge that subscribers are infringing, does that make it a willful infringer? And so, and Cox has there's a whole aspect of this case that I don't know if we have time to get into about the Twitter case and, you know, the difference between civil aiding and abetting and criminal aiding and abetting, which Cox is all too happy to elide. So there's a lot going on there. There's a recent Supreme Court case, 2023, about whether Twitter and Facebook, whoever, whether they could be liable, civil liability, aiding and abetting, because ISIS, like literally ISIS, was posting some kind of videos or something on these platforms. And so they got sued, and the court was like, no, merely providing these services is not culpable conduct. So you could see why Cox was like, ooh, that's, we love those decisions. And so there's a lot of reasons to think that maybe those decisions are different. You know, I mean, one of them is like, you know, terrorism law, and this is like copyright law. And, you know, but so on willfulness, Cox had a clever argument that said, well, under the Fourth Circuit's test, you know, we had knowledge from these notices that were sent by whoever. And so those knowledges made us a contributory infringer. Those notices gave us knowledge, made us contributory infringer, and that same knowledge made us willful infringers. And so, ergo, every contributory infringer is a willful infringer. That can't be the case, right? And so, so what's the solution there? So, I'm trying to remember, and I wish I'd written it down, but Clement had an answer to that. It did come up, and it was basically something. Oh, no, maybe it was in their brief. It was because it didn't come up yesterday. It should have come up. But it was something about how direct infringement is strict liability. So contributory infringement is you just have to intend to do the act. And willfulness is you intend the act to be infringing, something like that. They're trying to make a divide there. But to me, it's simple, is that you're starting from the presumption that you have to have some kind of culpable intent to be a material contribution infringer. And that's not true, right? So you can just have knowledge. You can be a contributory infringer just with knowledge. And then willfulness is more about intent. Like, I helped you out because I wanted you to infringe, right? So there's, I think these knowledge standards are, explain the difference between willful infringement for enhanced damages and the difference between inducement and contributory liability.
I should correct myself. It was in a chat. It was, damages were adjudicated at $99,000 and change per work. So willfulness would definitely matter here. You're mentioning civil and criminal aiding and abetting, and I want to point to the fantastic amicus brief that Bruce Boyden filed, where he really got deep into tort doctrine and said, no, we should look at the civil aiding and abetting standard. And I think demonstrates pretty convincingly that that is, I think, was a good standard and a standard that might have been intended at the time for material contribution and contributory liability. And I mean, it's always weird because, you know, we got into, I mean, so much of IP typically avoids these more traditional torts topics. But the doctrine is really, I mean, essential to, for understanding. But we should jump to material contribution briefly, because if we don't cover it, we haven't covered the main issue that is that was argued. So what do you think about and of course, on material contribution, the third petition treats it as there's big circuit split. And I was reading, I was like, really? I mean, because everyone agrees. I mean, the Fona Visa case out of California, Ninth Circuit, and Gershwin from the Second Circuit, essentially speak with one voice regarding material contribution. Fona Visa basically repeats it verbatim, and it's a pretty low standard. Fona Visa operating a flea market was sufficient to be contributorily liable for the infringement of a stall vendor. And Gershwin, who was acting as a booking agent, although Gershwin is a little more, although it defines contributory, it's more of a vicarious case. But yeah, do you think
you can go to the perfect 10 cases though, right, Z? Like, those are the ones I think of, because in one of the cases they said material contribution, but then in the other one they said it's not. And so you get so one of them was Google Image, right? So a Google Image search, there's a thumbnail of the image. And so you click on the image, it takes you to the infringing website. So that's like a part of the causal chain from how the user gets the image. And then the other case was the Visa. So it was like payment processors. And so, you know, maybe there's ads on these pirate websites and there's payment processors that. And so the court said, well, that's not material contribution because that's not part of the causal chain, right? There's got to be a nexus in the infringing activity, and that's too far remote, right? And I'm trying to remember. So I totally agree. Bruce Boyden's amicus brief, of all the ones I read, it's my absolute favorite. And I'm sorry, because I know you wrote one too, but yours was my second favorite. So, yeah, but it was amazing. I mean, he goes into, you know, the fact that you don't have to have intent for civil aiding and abetting liability, which ties into, you know, it's saying you just have to have knowledge. You don't have to intend that, you know, the person commit a crime in order to be liable civilly for aiding and abetting. And so, it's interesting because the record labels, the Sony Music and all them, are trying to say, oh, Twitter is completely different case. This isn't about aiding and abetting. I personally think, and I agree with you, that who cares about aiding and abetting? We're talking about copyright law, right? We're talking about civil liability for an intentional tort. You know, I don't care about, especially the doctrine as it came in criminal law. And I think it's important to note too that these aren't just like all common law doctrines. Like, Congress has stepped in when it didn't like the way that the courts were doing it. it like many times and said, no, this is how we're doing aiding and abetting. So it's not like it's just like this natural organic judge made thing that everybody could look at. You know, you have to look at the context. And so I don't think it's super helpful. But Bruce Boyden's brief, he actually made me want to believe in aiding and abetting and make aiding and abetting great again. Yeah, it's a great brief, and I wish I'd read it before we had this chat. I can't remember everything he said, but yeah.
Well, you bring up the perfect 10 cases, and we also have a question in the comments. How nice Peter from a telephone company. And the perfect 10 cases are interesting because I think the perfect 10 versus, it's so confusing called perfect 10 versus Amazon, but it's about Google Image. I know there's a procedural reason why, but it's endlessly confusing. In that case, the court said, listen, there's no vicarious here, but there may be contributory and they remand for more fact finding. On the Visa case, with a savage dissent by Judge Kaczynski, who had, I think the majority, Judge Smith, he says basically, I mean, if I can paraphrase the opinion, I can't break the internet, and this would break the internet. Perfect 10 runs a porno magazine. They sued Visa for payment processing of, I guess, illegal copies of their various and sundry materials on the internet. And the Judge Smith's held that payment processing for copyright infringement is real time every vicarious nor contributory liability. And knowledge is a little tricky, but I mean, material contribution. I mean, and if you look at his opinion, the material contribution section of that opinion is really weak. I mean, it's, I mean, I think there's a case being made that there was no liability and it's a knowledge in that case. But material contribution, I mean, you know, surely payment processing to keep the lights on for your pirate porno operation is making a material contribution. Yeah. I mean, frankly, much more than Sony v. Cox. And I think and the dissent calls that out.
Yeah, but it's not, I mean, if you took away the payment processors, the infringement still happens. If you take away Cox, then nobody's infringing. Yeah. I mean, if you go to a different ISP, but yeah, I mean, I think that's what they were saying. But I agree. Oh, you're right. Like it's that's more of, I feel like we're just doing vibes, right? We're just like this is vibe doctrine. I don't feel like, well, and this is you just reminded me, this is a thing that Bruce says, and he talks about the restatement formulation. So in aiding and abetting, it's not a material contribution, it's like substantial assistance, right? And so he goes all the way back, I think, to the first restatement from like the 30s, and they actually like have a list of factors. And so what was this? There was a recent DC Circuit case where this was the issue, Haberstrom or something. It came up yesterday. Something like that. Yeah. And so there are actually a list of factors, but then, you know, it's better than like vibes, you know, like, which is kind of what they're doing, but their nexus test. There is a certain logic to it where it's just causation is all they're saying. And so I agree with what you're saying is okay, but like, what about these other things that are also part of it and make it happen? And why are we just letting them get off the hook?
Yeah, you know, following that, I was thinking honestly of CCNV versus Reed, where they just imported restatement factors for whether someone's an employer. Law.
And it's so weird because it wouldn't that be a state law thing, like whether you're an employee or a contractor, and like every state might have a different, and they're just like, we're just going to take the restatement and that's now copyright law. It doesn't matter what your state says about your employment status. It matters what the restatement says.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's an interesting sort of thing. Now, material contribution, though, it's such an interesting. I mean, all of these cases except for Visa treat it as a fairly low bar. Basically, yeah. Saying you have given some assistance. What do you think? I mean, obviously, I think if the court affirms the Fourth Circuit, the result is going to be pretty ho-hum. It's going to be business as usual, frankly. And one thing that I think might have been, could have been better focused on in the argument is how, why has this case not come up more? And the answer is because you have to do a lot to lose 512. And if discovery, it hadn't been an absolute disaster, there was one other case pending, the Grande Communications case. Those are the only cases I'm aware of that where 512 is not held for an ISP, because it's a very, very high bar.
And we could have done this, what, 8 years ago if they had granted cert in the BMG v. Cox case.
Yeah.
They didn't. And so they're like, okay, we'll do it this time.
But I mean, I think for, I mean, but what do you think the effect would be, I mean, of reversal?
So, but reverse on what? I mean, I do. I don't think they're just going to affirm, right? I think there's too many questions about why are we talking about intent and purpose, and when it should it be knowledge, and there's so many weird things going on here. So I don't know. Like, so if Cox wins, what do they win on? So there's knowledge, right? But they. And this is where at the very beginning I said, you don't come in with your full arsenal of everything that you would like, you know. So they're not challenging the jury instructions. I think they forfeited that one. Right. They're challenging knowledge and they're challenging material contribution. And so knowledge was summary judgment. And
we're challenging knowledge. We're challenging willfulness. I know knowledge comes up, but
Yeah.
But it's really just material contribution and willfulness.
So, well, they forfeited the notice thing that, you know, so they can't say they don't have knowledge. So, but they are arguing that they don't have specific intent or culpable. They didn't do affirmative acts. There's no misfeasance or whatever, however they put it. Right. So, I mean, that's the first question presented is, can they be liable without some more culpable conduct? And so that's a knowledge thing. But everybody's agreeing intent, or at least that you can infer intent, right? I don't know. And this is so I was trying to think, you know, what's my takeaway prediction? And it's the worst prediction ever, which I think is that they're going to remand. And I don't know what it's going to be, something on, they may not even say anything about willfulness. Who knows? I mean, maybe in passing, but yeah, there's something they don't like. And I think there's, you know, they're trying to thread a lot of needles, because whatever they say here, it's copyright law, but it's, you know, this is judge made common law in action, and whatever they say here is going to apply to tort law generally, you know? And so they don't want to say anything too broad. And then I think back to Sony, where they used vicarious when they meant contributory, and they talked about staple articles, which have nothing to do with copyrights. And like, it wasn't the finest hour. was it Justice Stevens? I want to say it was Stevens. Yeah, it wasn't. I love him, but it wasn't his greatest opinion. And then Grokster, just the phrasing, you know, like contributory liability requires culpable intent. Okay, sure, for inducement, like. So I don't have a lot of hope that they're just going to nail this and it's going to be great. I guess my biggest hope would be that both sides get something and both sides lose something, and maybe meet them somewhere in the middle. I don't know. What do you think, Speak?
Well, so I'll tell you, we have a question in the chat. Is copyright infringement an intentional tort? And there's some wonderful scholarship that, because we tend to say yes, but there's been some scholarship that said, actually, if we really treat it as an intentional tort, it changes a whole bunch of things about copyright we probably don't want to change. So the answer is kind of, and I think that's kind of a tension in this case. Very copyright sort of exists as a discrete body of law, with these discrete standards, but you have Grokster saying, well, you have to go back to the well-established common law definitions. The reason why I've sort of been mentioning Bruce's brief a lot, aside from the fact that it's excellent, is that I think it does give the court a nice way out on material contribution. To say, no, you're both wrong, it is actually this standard, which won't really revolutionize the law, I think, but it will give it clarity. On willfulness, they should say that cert was improvidently granted, or do, I mean, willfulness is an enormous, enormous issue, given, especially as we just saw in the Anthropic case, given the fact it was a footnote in a lot of the briefs, not a footnote, but it was like 3 or 4 pages, and it was not argued at all. They shouldn't be giving, I mean, I would try to brush it off, say cert was improvidently granted or something on that issue, because it was not properly argued and it's an enormous issue.
Yeah. And what I would like to see is symmetry between patent law, copyright law, and trademark law. So, and there was an amicus brief in support of Cox by professors who were like, intentional torts, and there's these buckets and everything has to fit into the exact right bucket. And I'm like, yeah, but that's not how we do things, right? So it's, we come from those backgrounds, but everything's a little bit different in IP. What do you have? So in all three branches, copyright, patent, trademark, it's strict liability for direct infringement, right? And then for inducement, you have to have culpable intent, affirmative acts, advertising, whatever. So that's a very high mental scienter, or whatever you want to call it. And then in the middle, which is where we are. And so in patent law, you have for contributory patent infringement, you actually have a double knowledge standard. You have to know that the thing, and you have to know about know the acts are infringing, and you have to know about the patent. But it's knowledge, it's actual knowledge, but it's knowledge is the test. And then you go to trademark law, and it's know or should have known. So there's a slight difference in that in patent law, it's actual knowledge. In trademark law, you can have a should have known constructive knowledge standard. And then copyright law, it's knowledge. Let's just say knowledge. Stop talking about intent. Stop talking about purpose. And we could argue about whether it's actual knowledge or should have known or whatever, willful blindness. I think everybody agrees on that. I think it should be should have known. That's the standard in Gershwin. But it's not like Gershwin tells you where they got it from. Right. They're just like, here's the test. And there's like one site to some tort principle, or I don't know, like, so, but it's knowledge. So I would love to see the court take it up and say, okay, it's the Fourth Circuit got it right, but for the wrong reasons. And copyright owners, we're going to do you a favor. The test is knowledge, not intent, not purpose. A man can dream.
Yeah. I mean, willfulness. I mean, we have a situation now for willfulness where almost all infringements that are not quite possibly fair use or have been de facto willful anyway. I don't know. I'd love to have it get a full treatment. If we end up getting a ruling on willfulness that changes things right now out of a case where it wasn't argued, it would be a curious result. But I think we're at an hour. Any final thoughts?
No, I mean, I have so many thoughts. I'm not going to hold my breath. I'll just say that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening, and I'll give it back to Sarah.
Thank you to you both for speaking with us today. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can also stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.